Good afternoon. Welcome to the Heritage Foundation. I'm John Hilbolt, Director of Lectures and Seminars. I'm pleased to welcome everyone to our Lehrman Auditorium, and especially those who join us on each occasion via our heritage.org website. As we always remind our website viewers, questions can be submitted to our guest via email, addressed simply to speaker@heritage.org. And for those in-house, we thank you now for checking that cell phones have been turned off to avoid other interference in the room. At General Electric, progress is our most important product. With that sign-off line, Ronald Reagan concluded each episode of the General Electric Theater television program in the 1950s. With technological innovation and progress may have been the driving force of the corporation, for Ronald Reagan, his 8-year association with GE involved progress of a different sort. Looking back now, I realize that it wasn't a bad apprenticeship for someone who'd someday enter public life, he wrote in his autobiography. Those GE tours became almost a postgraduate course in political science for me. For historians, however, details of these formative years, 1954 to 1962, and their true impact on the development of Ronald Reagan's broader political philosophy have been somewhat obscure, until now. Our special guest today is Thomas W. Evans, a Wall Street litigator and avocational politician, as his biography states. He has supervised a successful New Hampshire presidential primary, established a National Citizens Campaign organization. He has served as adjunct professor of education and administration at Columbia University's Teacher College. His previous books in the field of education include The School in the Home and Mentors Making a Difference in Our Public Schools. A graduate of Columbia Law School, his legal publications include Admissions Practice and the PLI series on nuclear litigation, where he was editor and co-author. I might add parenthetically, I'm glad I am not the book publicist for that last one. I'm sure it did not quite make the bestseller list of the New York Times. Mr. Evans' knowledge of politics, however, stems largely from his years with the Mudge Rose firm. Many of you may remember it more as Nixon Mudge, where he was a senior litigator and for a decade managing partner. While never serving in the Nixon administration, Mr. Evans was counsel to the Points of Light Foundation under President George H.W. Bush. And in the Reagan administration, he served for 8 years as chairman of the National Symposium on Partnerships in Education. For today's event, through interviews with former GE employees, he was led to a cache of key private papers that had never been published, and to archives of GE documents housed not at the company, but at a museum that had not been seen for over half a century. We are pleased to welcome him to Heritage today to learn more about the obscure years in the history of one of our nation's great leaders, Ronald Reagan. Please join me in welcoming Tom Evans to Heritage. Tom?
Well, thank you, John Hilbolt, for that very nice introduction and for the wonderful work you do here at the Foundation. I'd like to express thanks also to Ed Fulner, who I understand is in Europe, and note right now the significant role that the Heritage Foundation played in the Reagan administration in many ways, but what I'm thinking of now, and it's in my book, is the Mandate for Leadership, which were studies of various subjects which Ronald Reagan thought were important to the progress of the country. And teams under Fulner's leadership looked into this, prepared the Mandate for Leadership, and it was required reading for the cabinet officers and other incoming officials in the Reagan administration. If Ronald Reagan were here right now giving a talk on what he would probably call, even though we're not having a lunch, the mashed potato circuit, one of his favorite phrases, in addition to using his 4x6 cards, he would do something that I'm not doing today because I have a little different physical circumstance. As he got up, he would take a contact lens out of his eye in those days before teleprompters. He was extremely nearsighted, and he would use the naked eye to read the cards and the contact lens enhanced eye to look out at the audience. So now you probably know more than you even wanted to know about Ronald Reagan, but that was his method of speaking, as I say, before teleprompters. On October 27, 1964, Ronald Reagan gave a national televised speech in support of Republican presidential candidate Barry Goldwater. Afterwards, David Broder, the dean of the Washington Press Corps, then as now, said that it was the most successful political debut since William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech in 1896, 2 years after the speech. And by the way, that's the way it was referred to by critics and supporters alike thereafter, the speech. 2 years after that, Ronald Reagan was elected governor of California in his first bid for political office by a margin of almost 1 million votes. Reagan learned more than just a set of prepared remarks at GE, although he said at the time of the Goldwater speech, which turned out to be the most successful fundraising speech in the history of politics until that date, that he'd been giving that speech for 10 years. In fact, as you'll see as you read this book, he did give variations of that speech, and they were modeled also on the speech of his mentor, Lemuel Boulware, Boulware's first speech articulating these things is appended to the book, and it was given in 1949. But in the course of his education, Ronald Reagan learned the writings of such diverse authors as von Mises, Lenin, Hayek, Sun Tzu, and read and reread the Practical Economics of Henry Hazlitt and other conservative economists. Writings of all of these individuals were made available to Reagan during that period, and later, as we study his education, we'll see how it is that he learned this massive amount of material. But let's begin first with Reagan the student. I'd then like to go to the context of his education and then the educational institution, General Electric itself. The student, what were his natural gifts, if you will? Well, for one thing, he was a reader. He was almost an obsessive reader. He enjoyed the process greatly. He was also an early reader. I note that he was an early reader in the book. One of the scenes that is mentioned about young Ronald Reagan is a day when his father was seated in the living room and he was lying on the floor, young Ron was, or Dutch as he was then known. And his father said, "Well, what are you doing, Dutch?" And his father said, "I'm reading the newspaper, Daddy." He was 4 or 5 years old at the time, was before he entered school, and his father said, "Well, oh, that's very nice. Why don't you read it aloud so I can hear it?" And he proceeded to read from the newspaper, verbatim, aloud, and his father at that point jumped up and went and got his wife, Nellie, and she came in, and Dutch continued to read it, and then they stopped again. They went out and they got the neighbors. They brought them in. And this became almost a folk rite. They'd have a group of neighbors in every couple of weeks, and Dutch would read the newspaper to them. So he was an early reader. David Gergen commented many, many years later that he was a slow reader. And Gergen went on to say because he had a tendency to memorize what he read. And Gergen said that went back, in his view, to the Hollywood days in reading scripts and learning scripts. In studying Ronald Reagan, the student, the raw material, if you will, that came to GE in 1954, I think it's useful also to recap his first public speech. As you know, when Ronald Reagan first ran for governor of California, and later when he became governor, the issue of student unrest was a major issue. Of course, the students were using obscene language, were destroying buildings, and so on. And Pat Brown, the incumbent governor, was not dealing with the situation, in Reagan's view, and later it turned out in the view of a majority of the voters in California. And it was a major issue for him. But Ronald Reagan's first public speech was given in a different era of student unrest, if you will, in 1928, as Ronald Reagan went to Eureka College in Illinois. The president of the college, whose name was Wilson, had decided to cancel a number of courses as an economy measure. This meant that a number of seniors could not graduate. The students viewed this and other changes as extremely difficult, unmanageable elements in their education. And so before they went home for Thanksgiving vacation, they met in the largest building on campus, the chapel. And it was absolutely packed. There were students outside standing by the open windows listening to the speech. And the student leaders decided that that speech on this key issue should be given by freshman Ronald Reagan, who had been on campus for 2 months. And Dutch Reagan got up and gave that speech, interrupted frequently by applause, and then he paused and he presented a resolution to the students that would have been extreme even in the 1960s. He said, "We, the students of Eureka College, resolve that we shall go on strike, that we shall not attend classes until the president submits his resignation." There was a pause. Suddenly somebody said, "You tell them, Dutch," and the ovation started and the student stood up, gave him a prolonged standing ovation, and when they came back from Thanksgiving break, they went on strike. No one attended classes. Well, I shouldn't quite say no one. President Wilson's two daughters attended classes, but other than that, it was virtually unanimous. It was a major national incident. The wire services came to the college campus and reported it. There was a rumor that the campus would have to be shut down. There was another rumor that they would move to Springfield. And 3 weeks later, the president resigned. The courses were restored, and other reforms were put in. So this was the first public speech of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, when he came to GE, was a liberal, as he described himself, a hemophiliac liberal, a Democrat, a New Dealer to the core. The second photograph in my book is of Reagan at the White House, the Truman White House. He's standing with three other labor leaders. He was president of the Screen Actors Guild at the time, and they were waiting to see President Truman, who was going to thank them for the job that they had done. Ronald Reagan was the organizer of Labor for Truman in 1948 in the state of California. In 1950, he supported Helen Gehagen Douglas in her unsuccessful bid against Richard Nixon for the U.S. Senate in California. True, in 1952, he supported General Eisenhower, but as a Democrat for Eisenhower. I want to give you now the context that pertained before Ronald Reagan came to General Electric. In 1946, the unions throughout the country went on strike. They had, during World War II, maintained a no-strike pledge during the war effort. They felt that no longer bound them after the war, and there was a 17-week national strike which brought management to its knees. Management throughout the country, including GE, learned that they were no match for organized labor. They did not have the skills or the knowledge to mount a campaign to combat the power of union officials. At GE, however, they learned a second lesson. There were a number of companies wholly owned by GE, but which did not use the GE name, Hot Point, Carbaloy, and others. They were of sufficient size so that if they'd been independent, they would have been well into the Fortune 500 list. They had annual revenues of $150 million. They had 15,000 employees, and they were supervised by Lemuel Boulware. Boulware had come to GE from the War Production Board with Charles Wilson and Ralph Cordner, a rare thing, really, three men going to one company from a very prominent government agency. The second lesson learned at GE was that none of the companies supervised by Lemuel Boulware went out on strike. Almost unique in the response to this 17-week strike that had pertained throughout the country. And so Charles Wilson, who was then CEO of GE, by the way, he was called, as some of you may know, Charlie, Electric Charlie, because there was another Charles E. Wilson who was heading General Motors, who they called Engine Charlie. So Electric Charlie did what he often did. This is a key lesson that Ronald Reagan learned as well. He liked to put in long-range plans. He liked to have a plan that was being followed by the people in charge. And he did what any intelligent CEO would do. They put all of the labor relations at GE and community relations and public relations under Lemuel Boulware. Now, Boulware was a marketing expert, one of the reasons he came to GE, and he developed a plan. But let me put it in further context. After this great victory in 1946, Walter Reuther gave a speech, and you will find it appended to this book, in which he said that organized labor cannot be content simply to enter into collective bargaining and deal with narrow labor issues. We must do what is best for the community, teach the community what is best for itself, and lead the community to goals of which far exceed what we do at the bargaining table. Reuther, by the way, had a socialist background in his family. He had voted for Norman Thomas. He had switched to the Democratic Party, but George Romney once said, Romney was governor of Michigan at the time, that Reuther was the most dangerous man in Detroit because he could bring about a revolution without people knowing that that's just what he intended to do. If you will, the answer to Reuther came from Lemuel Boulware speaking to the Harvard Business School graduating class and alumni participating in that festive week in 1949 at Harvard. By the way, I do not claim in the book that Boulware's speech created the eventual accomplishments of the class of 49. But it's universally regarded as the most successful class in the history of Harvard Business School. Fortune reported that 25 years later at their reunion, and just 3 years ago a book came out again about this legendary class of 49. I interviewed a lot of them, though, about Boulware's speech that day. And it basically said, first of all, that the businessmen have to clean up their act. They are viewed as greedy and selfish, and people did not respect them. And they had to look into the image that they were creating. With huge success in business, they were nevertheless failing with the public in this aspect. But he said also they had to learn why they were successful. They had to study the free enterprise system and learn why it worked. And he said that this education has to take place in schools, in classes. It has to take place at the local club. It has to take place at the bar, on trains. This education is key to the success in opposing the union officials. And he pointed out in his speech that the economic well-being of the blue-collar workers is often a quite different goal than the political objectives of the union officials. Now, the educational institution involved in carrying out the education that Boulware describes in his remarks at Harvard Business School, and along with Ruther's speech, they are in the appendix of the book. I found, by the way, that this will be shocking. Often, or maybe not often, but there are many examples of politicians who write their own speeches, leaders who write their own speeches and believe in them and try to carry them out. And this is certainly true in the three speeches that I've appended to the book. Ruther's, who was one of the most successful labor leaders in the history of the United States, Boulware at Harvard, and finally, the speech of Ronald Reagan in 1964, A Time for Choosing. What do I mean when I describe GE as an educational institution? When Time magazine did its cover story on GE in 59, it pointed out that at GE there were 32,000 students, which was more at the time than Harvard and Yale combined. GE had a school that Fortune called the Harvard of Corporate America, where GE executives largely attended to learn the management theories of Ralph Kordner. Jack Welch later on pointed out that the course involved some 3,500 pages of material that was studied at Crotonville at GE School. Boulware preferred to have his classes conducted at, by the way, the management techniques promulgated by Ralph Kordner, which Ronald Reagan had an opportunity to observe and read about, were the only management precepts that he was close to, other than the megalomaniac activities of the studio heads, which were really a highly individualized system of management, and one certainly not to be followed anyplace else, and was eventually defeated in the course of as the Screen Actors Guild went on strike under Ronald Reagan years later. But Boulware would conduct classes at the plants. And these classes, granted they had some on technical skills and the rest, but basically he wanted the blue-collar workers to realize that there was more in their lives than simply seeking a higher wage. It was a matter of, well, first of all, he knew from his studies that over half of them were shareholders of GE. He knew also they had outside interests. They wanted programs that might give them better insurance, and he developed such programs. They wanted programs that would give them an opportunity to go to college at the expense of the corporation if they wanted to move into other jobs. And these things were developed by Lemuel Boulware. Boulware, in 1954, hired Ronald Reagan. It's interesting. Reagan was an entertainer. He was to be the host of the General Electric Theater, but he went on Boulware's payroll right from the start. He was to tour the country, go to the plants, And as GE's most famous face, because the GE Theater was an extremely well-rated television show, he would give the company a sense of cohesion. It had 250,000 employees, and that's larger than all but 40 U.S. cities at the time. It was spread out in 139 plants in 40 states. So Reagan had the plant tour, and he gave Hollywood patter as he went along the assembly line. He answered questions. And by the way, the traveling aides, and I quote it in the book, point out that he never wanted to be embarrassed, so the questions that came from the workers were often a point that he wanted to cover in advance to the extent that he could. They were receiving a huge amount of materials from Lemuel Boulware. And let me interject that after I started this book, and as a lawyer, there was extensive litigation on what was called Boulwareism. And I read those litigation papers, and that was the beginning of my work on the book. But I had a practice every time I met a somewhat older GE employee or former employee, I would say, were you there when Reagan was there? Were you there when Boulware was there? And finally, I looked into a cache of papers that a secretary, I was actually trying to speak to her, the man she worked for, and she said, you know, I put together the collected papers of Lemuel Boulware and I sent them to the University of Pennsylvania in the archives. And so I had thousands of pages of confidential papers, internal memos, that no one had seen. And another employee, when I said, I can't get any materials, any documents from GE, they don't seem to have archives. And he sort of looked at me, he said, of course they don't, they're in a museum in Schenectady. And I went up to this museum, and they had something called the Electric Wing, and they had all of the documents I'd been asking GE about. Nobody at GE told me where they were, and I found out that nobody really, or very few people, had been through those documents. I'm going to wrap up, but before I do, I want to tell you a little more about the process of education and how Ronald Reagan came to learn something about those 3,500 pages of documents that were taught at Crotonville, and also about the four magazines that were put out by Lemuel Boulware. Every Friday, the Works News went out to the local GE plant papers. So if you were reading the Schenectady News in your Schenectady plant, or if you were in the outdoor lighting plant down in North Carolina, along with articles about how your representative was doing in the Miss GE contest or how the team was doing in the local bowling league, there was information which Boulware was supplying on excessive taxation, the intrusion of government into the everyday life of individuals, and other things that he felt that the balanced best interest of the blue-collar worker involved. They needed education in this area and certainly wouldn't get it often from other sources. He even had book clubs. For 13 weeks they would read Economics in one lesson by Henry Hazlitt, the leading conservative economic textbook at the time. And the book clubs, first of all, gave them that information with discussions on for the whole period. And second, they were focus groups. Boulware knew about focus groups. He was one of the authors of the National Marketing Society's report on modern methods of survey and interest. So when the union did its head-to-head poll and found that 92% of their workers were in favor of a strike, he'd had his focus groups. You know, they weren't really in favor of a strike. They didn't want to stay out more than a week. Most of them didn't want to go out. But when they were given that head-to-head question in a union poll with people looking over their shoulders and the rest of it, that's the way that came out. So there was this tremendous amount of information, and two different traveling aides I quote in the book point out that Reagan initially felt he had to read all of this material because he was going to be asked about it as he went through the plants. He started giving speeches and he became part of the Boulware operation, especially as they went to the grassroots. And if you look at those states that they went through, you will find the states that went from blue to red in current parlance. These were almost all Democratic southern states where GE plants were located, and they were converted in significant part by the operations of GE. The question of how Ronald Reagan mastered this material comes from a little-known idiosyncrasy. The GE Theater in those days was doing live television on the East Coast, and they were beginning to film some shows on the West Coast. Because Reagan was leader of the Screen Actors Guild and popular in Hollywood, he got a lot of outstanding actors and actresses, but they didn't want to leave Hollywood, so they started filming there. How did Reagan get back and forth? Well, he had a fear of flying. It was built into his contract that he would not fly. He took the train, the Super Chief, and other luxury trains, and he loved to read, and he absorbed this material in his so-called study halls on these trains, knew it very well. I'm going to ask you for questions, but I'll mention just two other quick points. One, in the magazines I mentioned, they dealt with a number of different kinds of issues. One of the magazines was called The Forum. It was the General Electric Defense Quarterly. And if you read the January 1963 issue, I don't think many of you will, but in the occasion, if you did read it, you would see an article by Robert Strauss-Huppe and Robert Kintner, which describes the need for a doctrine, and then goes through the doctrine, and I tell you right now, that became the Reagan Doctrine. And also in that article, they say that we should have a shield from incoming missiles, that if we are to be subjected to possible nuclear attack, this is what we need. And they quote von Clausewitz originally, and then they go to the current situation. And by the way, GE was in that business of having to do with intercontinental missiles. And this is the first mention. Edward Teller, certain generals, others are given credit for bringing to the attention of Ronald Reagan the Nuclear Defense Shield, SDI. It came from the GE Quarterly. And by the way, one of the authors was appointed ambassador to Turkey by Ronald Reagan, and the other was given credit for these writings in other areas by Reagan. Final point before I open it for questions. Ronald Reagan learned a great deal in terms of economic philosophy, political skills, while he was working for GE. The word, by the way, that Boulware used for the GE employees who adopted this information and then gave it to others was communicator. He wanted them to be communicators, and then he said mass communicators. And one of them went a little beyond that. But the other skill that Ronald Reagan learned, which was so important, was the art of negotiation. We've had only one president who was a union leader, and that is Ronald Reagan. I have a chapter which begins with a telegram, and this is when Reagan was on the road giving speeches similar to the speech. There's a telegram from George Meany to Ronald Reagan saying, "I support you in your quest for fair treatment." Well, that was written to him in Reagan's capacity as president of the Screen Actors Guild. And believe it or not, in 1960, when the GE contract came to an end and they were negotiating a new contract with a strike being threatened, the Screen Actors Guild contract came to an end also. And the GE spokesman, in his capacity as president of the Screen Actors Guild, was confronted with the issue of whether to take his workers out on strike, which he did. For the first time, they got compensation for their films being shown on television, and it was a huge move forward. So Reagan was able to become not only the great communicator, but the great negotiator as a result of his GE education. Thank you all. We'll take some questions.
I want you to do one other thing that's in the book. Most people today presume that the theater was a relatively easy job. Go into studio, tape the programs shown on air, occasional visits to a factory. Just tell them briefly, as you do in the book, a one-day factory visit. Quick outline, how many hours, what's involved, and the fact that the president wasn't always diplomatic and probably wouldn't have gotten by with some of his statements in today's world.
Yes. Well, especially later as he started giving speeches, the typical day would be to get up very early in the morning and go to an assembly line. He'd be on the assembly line, and occasionally, he was extremely well received by the workers. They'd shut down what they were doing, and they'd come over and talk with him, and he was quite popular. But occasionally, you'd hear a voice from the back say, "What about Jane Wyman? Why did she dump you?" And he would come back with, "Well, I'm sure she couldn't put up with you either, Buster." Or he came back with various responses, and he developed a real rapport with the workers. And he said, in terms of conversion, and he used the word conversion, it was after realizing that the things that he was learning in his dialogue with the workers and speaking about on the mashed potato circuit, and he realized one day that the things that he was opposing were being led, if you will, those elements were being led by people he was supporting. And he said that, "I'm no longer a Democrat." Now, it took until 1962 for him to change his registration. He was giving a speech for Nixon, who was running for governor in 1962, and Reagan a woman raised her hands in the audience and said, "Are you a Republican?" And he said, No, I'm not. I haven't gotten around to changing my registration yet." And she said, "I'm a registrar." And she walked forward and she put a form in front of him and he signed it and then he gave it back to her and she went back to her seat and he said, "Now where was I?" But he would then, to pursue what John was saying, he would, in the course of a day, he'd be on the assembly line. He would then talk at lunch to some of the executives. He would then go to another plant or another part of the plant. He would then have a reception in the evening. And then they might have a dinner at a local club where he would speak to GE executives, or especially later in his career, he would be speaking to the Junior Chamber of Commerce, the Chamber of Commerce, the Kiwanis, or others. By the way, when he left GE, at that point, and I bumped into the man who was the guest of a guest at a cocktail party, and went through my, he had gray hair, and I went through my routine. He was with GE, and I said, "Did you ever know Bulwer?" He said, "Oh." He said, "I dismantled Bulwerism." And so I later interviewed him at some length. And they did dismantle Bulwerism, and then they went back to it about a year later. They realized that it worked. But in that period, when there was a kind of a negative feeling, and GE had other massive public relations problems as a result of an antitrust case, at that period, they met with Ronald Reagan, and they said, we want you to tone down the speeches. Don't give speeches. Just talk about the product and go back to the Hollywood patter." And he said, "Well, thank you, but no thank you. I'm going to leave the company." They canceled the GE Theater. He left the company at that time. By the way, at that time and shortly before that, only one man in the country had more speaking invitations than Ronald Reagan, and that was Dwight Eisenhower. He was in tremendous, tremendous demand.
Tom's going to recognize questioners. Just wait for the microphone that Angela will be glad to pass around. I think there's one down
here. We've got one right here.
Thank you. I enjoyed your speech.
Thank you.
What are the principles? Bulwerism is new to me. I glanced at it in the book. Forgive my ignorance. What are the principles? What are the sort of foundational points that constitute bulwerism?
Okay.
Thank you.
First of all, the word bulwerism still exists. It is in the labor law text, basically. Bulwerism, broadly, was viewed, and I quote two or three commentators, including the former president of Harvard, Derek Bach, who's an expert on labor law, as saying Bulwerism was the most significant labor movement of two or three decades. It was, however, as it's used today, the narrow aspect of Bulwerism is management puts a contract on the table. They say, this is our full and fair offer. Bulwer felt that the traditional practice of coming in with a low offer and then raising it was something that he wanted no part of. And his studies showed that when that was done, the union officials got all the credit for what eventuated, and he felt it was better to put the offer on the table. Now, the narrow version of Bulwerism is take it or leave it. And in Bulwer's 14 years with GE, as he points out, they changed offers on a number of occasions, but they were changed only when new facts came in. For example, in the focus groups, he discovered the employees wanted accident insurance. Somebody had said maybe they could get some inexpensive accident insurance. And he looked into it. He put some people in charge of that. He came back and said, we're going to offer it to the employees. And the union leaders said, well, fine, just put it in the package. And he said, no, it's going right to the employees. If they want it, they can sign up for it. If they don't, it's up to them as individuals. So this is another part of Bulwerism, and a very important one, going over the heads of the union leaders directly to the blue-collar workers. As was pointed out in the litigation on Bulwerism by Chief Judge Irving Kaufman in the Second Circuit, the workers got as many as 4 direct communications a day from Bulwer's operation, and they had all of these publications and so on. So going over the heads of the workers is another aspect of Bulwerism. But the broadest definition is that he was teaching that excessive taxation, excessive government interference, had a very negative effect on the free market system. He was a free enterprise individual, and Bulwerism in the broader aspect is teaching those elements to the electorate, whether it's the blue-collar workers in the company or the voters at the grassroots. And Bulwer went into, first of all, the methodology of how to do that, how to win elections. And then he went into the ideology that I've described to you, which is basically a conservative ideology. Let me just mention a point here, one of the little things I found in the course of looking into this. GE established, through civic organizations, courses in how to win elections. They were called Better Business Climate courses, and they were nonpartisan. As it happens, though, they drew a lot of conservatives, and they tended to change things. One of the consultants who helped design that, who would always be on the panels, who worked with the people who went to these forums, and who was a GE paid consultant, was F. Clifton White, who later led the draft Goldwater movement. So Bulwer was in this fight very early. Bill Buckley, Goldwater was one of the early supporters of National Review, and Bill Buckley later said, we're going to build a statue to you. You've given us the leadership that we have not had before this. So he was, he never wanted to claim credit. He didn't want the public attention on these things, and Reagan had the same thinking, the same methodology, as you know. But it was basically a role of huge strength and persuasion. Do we have another question? Yes, sir.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation and an even more interesting book.
Thank you.
I had very brief connections with Bulwer as a junior staffer when he was on a board of an organization I worked for. And I just wanted to I guess, ask two different kind of questions.
Yes.
One on Bulwerism. It seemed part of what he was after was giving the worker a sense that of the economic dynamics that provided for his job, and that there was a limit to what they could go for, as opposed to kind of an abstract economic machine that they could keep demanding things without any consequences to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so a sense of fairness based on what the economy and the business could provide, I think, was an important part of the educational effort. The question I originally wanted to ask was, do you see any business leadership like Bulwer with his remarkable influence today? Because business leaders certainly have the same bad PR with, you know, 400 times what the average worker does.
Yes.
And is there anything today that you've seen in your study of this fascinating individual?
Well, I guess my quick answer would be no. It's a... as you look back in history, there are certain leaders who really sort of transcend the mold, and I think Bulwer was in that category. Also, in viewing the difference between union officials and union members in terms of objectives, Bulwer went right to the union members, as I've mentioned. But let's face it, in the period we've been talking about, a third of the nation's workforce were in unions. Today it's less than 10%, and if you took out the government employee unions, it would be minuscule. Bulwer won. In the strike, by the way, at GE, when the workers went out on strike, a New York Times writer at the time said that this was the greatest defeat that any union had received in the history of American business after a strike. And it was... So I don't see it now. There may well be, and I'm probably doing a disservice, and we might expect a knock on the door at any minute from Mitt Romney, who would say, now, wait a minute, who did have a very successful business career before he went into politics. But I don't see anybody quite in Bulwer's mold. Why don't we take...
One more?
Yes.
Thank you for your talk today. I'm Betty Cook, retired. And my curiosity is, how did Ronald Reagan reconcile his liberal position, beliefs, with taking the position with GE, which was obviously a capitalistic position?
Well, first of all, as far as Ronald Reagan was concerned, the GE job had no political aspect at all. He was to be on the assembly line with Hollywood Patter, and he was going to talk about products. Ironically, the role they wanted him to play in 1962, when he decided to leave GE because he had developed into, if you will, a different kind of person. He had his anti-communism early because of the battle in Hollywood for union leadership and in other aspects with the communists. Reagan in those days was supplied a steady companion by the FBI. He was authorized and asked by the Burbank police to carry a pistol because there were threats of violence. So he had the anti-communism, if you will, early. He always had a huge sense of patriotism. I quote one of the speeches that he gave before he came to GE called the America the Beautiful speech, given at William Woods College in Fulton, Missouri. And it's very patriotic, but it has none of the economic aspects that you were wondering about. So I think that in answer to your question, there was no conflict when he first came to GE, and these things developed over the years. And he was, he learned and was convinced and had the conversion.
Thank you.
Was there one other question here? No? Okay. Thank you all.
For those who may be interested in Mr. Boulware's continued life, he did survive to see President Reagan inaugurated. And in fact, the president took a picture of that inauguration and sent it to him with the inscription, "Thanks to your help, this moment was possible." So there are a lot of people we don't know about in the backgrounds of famous individuals. We do thank you for your kind attention. We do have copies of the book available in the lobby where our author will sign them for you. Thank you. We are dismissed.